who are just awash in cash because they get these tax deductible donations. And personally, I'm a firm believer in doing away with those deductions. We're in a serious economic crisis right now. The fact that the Bush administration cannot seem to keep this economy propped up with more borrowing and more spending tells me that the system is really, really in big trouble. And for me, I think a good place to start would be right here, taking money away from groups like this this American Family Foundation or Association, who's out there, you know, they're supposed to be a religious group, yet they're firmly in the political arena. So to me, they're not a religious group. They're a political advocacy group.
Yes? Absolutely. First of all, why should that surprise any of us? At the end of the day, when they feel threatened, what do? They try to throw the fear factor in. They try to divide us. I ran into a gentleman. I mean, he could be a real caricature. You could put on a skit on Saturday Night Live. We started talking about the election. And out of the clear blue sky, he says, "Have you read your Bible? Have you read your Bible and the moral issues that are up, that are really concerned to me in this election? Don't you know that Barack Obama is pushing the homosexual agenda and he's pushing abortion? He will rot in hell for that." And he sincerely believed that. That was the only issue to him. I mean, why should we be surprised they have done this now for three elections? And that's all they have. I do believe they're overshooting their mark. I believe the American people have saw through that. There are moral issues, sure. And you can even use the Bible. But if you're going to use the Bible, let's look at the Bible in its entirety. If you want to play the religious card, Barack Obama can use the religious card, too. And I'm just talking on an argumentative basis here. Feeding children, taking care of those who are in need in this country, be they children or be they senior citizens, providing basic health care, providing the means for the head of the family, who they say they cherish, allowing the head of the household to provide an adequate standard of living for their family. That has to be a moral issue, too. And in fact, it is.
Well, I mean, love thy neighbor. I mean, that's a big one. Thou shalt not kill. I mean, you look at the policies of this administration and the number of people that have been killed by this administration. There's something wrong here. Something seriously wrong. And I appreciate the email. It just makes me wonder, because, you know, you look at the amount of money that's just being thrown at these churches, and they're building these massive mega churches. And it to me, and it just seems like this, I don't know. It scares me to death, I'll tell you that. Anyway, I don't know how many people saw this on Friday. George Bush sent Dick Cheney to give a speech to the White House conference on North American wildlife policy in Reno, Nevada. And amazingly, Mr. Shoot-'em-up, he thinks the Bush administration has championed wildlife preservation. And, you know, the guy who comes to Pennsylvania and shoots 90 birds out of a barrel, and, you know, the guy who just loves killing stuff, didn't quite get the shot on his buddy, but, you know, he still shot him anyway. Maybe him and Palin can go hunting. There's a good way to get rid of Sarah Palin. Send her out hunting with Shooter Dick. But anyway, Dick Cheney said, as speaking to this crowd, as all of you know very well, President Bush made wildlife conservation an early and high priority in his administration.
I know the human being and fish can coexist peacefully.
Yeah, that was his high priority. Cheney goes on to say, "We've carried out that commitment in these 8 years, and we've been proud to have people like you as partners in the enterprise." In the enterprise. The men and women in this room understand what conservation is all about. And it means reverence towards, get this, creation and commitment to faithful stewardship. I mean, talking in their language. You got to understand who these folks are. You got to talk in their language, creationism, you know, faith and all that. He goes on to say it means guarding our spectacular wildlife populations, not just for our own time, but for all time. of conservation voters, one of the groups out there who it is their job to keep an eye on what's going on with the environment, they've said that the Bush administration is the most anti-environmental administration in the history of this nation. And really, any thoughtful person who looks at this administration and sees some of the things that they've done over the last 8 years, they're going to agree. This has been one of the most anti-environmental administrations in history, opening up those 25 coal-fired electric plants and just allowing mercury to spew everywhere. Why? More profit. And then calling that part of their Clear Skies Initiative. Yeah, clear of any birds. but there are some other things. You know, there were rules proposed by the Bush administration that would have effectively gutted the Endangered Species Act, no longer requiring the federal agencies to consult with Fish and Wildlife Services or with National Marine Fisheries Services to determine if a project would harm an endangered species. Nope, we're not going to think about that anymore. It's just about getting what we can get out of it. In fact, you remember when they suspended a whole bunch of Endangered Species Act rules? When they wanted to build their little fence on the Mexican border, they gave Chertoff the ability to just go ahead, tear everything up. We don't care. That, kill everything. You know, they'll figure it out. And my other favorite, my absolute favorite, was saying, you know, we want to allow snowmobiles in Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Parks. So just, you know, so the rich folks can go and, you know, go zooming around the trees. Makes no sense at all. But, you know, this is the guy who, quite honestly, is the champion of environmental issues. In March of 2007, Salon Magazine reported that the Bush administration had granted only 57 species endangered status to different species, the lowest of any administration in history. In 2005, the Fish and Wildlife scientists had a survey that reported that they had been forced to alter or withhold findings that would have led to greater protections for endangered species. And, I mean, it just goes back to more of what this administration does. And, you know, I got to give Bush a little credit, though. He has a sense of humor. His reasoning for not going to give this speech to this group, he said that at the last minute, he wanted to send his favorite hunter in his place, alluding to the little face shot incident. So I thought that was kind of funny. The thing you got to give credit to Bush about is he's just nasty to everybody. You know, calling his the number one guy who put him in office, calling him turd blossom. You know, you got Colin Powell. He called him balloon foot because he got hit with a. I forget what the name of the. In Vietnam, they had those. We used to put the sticks underground and put feces on top of them. And he had a really bad infection where his foot blew up to like five times what it was. Well, there you go, balloon foot. It's taking a tragedy and making fun of it. That's the Bush administration. I don't know. Let's take a break. We're going to come back and we're going to do a labor report finally. So, the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. RickSmithShow.com. This week, back in 1949, the steelworkers won an increase in security after years of scandal and corruption, as well as the passage of anti-union legislation The years that followed World War II were frustrating for organized labor. The movement scored a victory on October 1st, 1949, when 500,000 disgruntled steelworkers called a strike that eventually would win them improved retirement benefits. You know, it's these kind of fights, these kind of instances where working people have stuck together. I mean, 500,000 people sticking together saying, you know what, we want a better tomorrow. We demand a better slice of the fruits of our labor. You know, Jake, you know, sometimes I wonder when we're going to go back to that, because we have to. We have to return to those days where working people are in solidarity with one another.
Well, we talked about that, and sometimes you do draw the conclusion that maybe things have to get so bad that people aren't left a choice. I'm hoping it doesn't come to that. I think we can change this country around short of that, and we have a golden opportunity on Election Day. But if we don't, you can bet. You can bet, as sure as you and I are sitting here, things will get worse.
You know, and another piece of history, back in 1932, and I actually remember reading about this years and years ago. The state militia in Illinois was called out after 164 school students, high school students in Kincaid, Illinois, went on strike when the school board bought coal from the Scab Peabody Coal Company back in 1932. Now, you think about the kids today. Do you think they understand? Do you think they care where the books come from, where the paper comes from, or any of the things that they use in their school comes from? I mean, do you think you'd get 164 kids today to go walk out of the classroom on strike to help working people? I got to wonder. And the thing is, you know, here's the thing. 1932, you're in the height of the Depression. So you what you have is you have some consciousness. And I've been saying it for a while. I think we need that. We need that crisis to bring people back together. It's more of that shock doctrine. But unfortunately, the shocks of the last 30 years have gone to benefit the conservative ideology, to benefit that pro-business movement. I think we need to go back, and this financial crisis right now could be one of those moments, could be that catalyst that brings people together. Because, you know, Congress was saying, you know, 9 out of 10 people calling are dead set against bailing Wall Street out. And I'm dead set against it, only I understand the ramifications if we don't for everyone. That's why I'm more, you know, pulling me by my teeth to get in there and allow it to happen. But
well, if I can make a comment quickly, you're exactly right. Out there on the main street, the majority of the people are opposed to it. I think those in power tried to use the critical stage as leverage and say, hey, we got to rush into this, let's go. We absolutely have to do something, but I think we have to do it in a prudent, rational manner and not expect the American people to accept everything that comes down the line that shouldn't be there. And there are some in Congress, and quite frankly, I think Congressman Holden, my congressman, who's voted twice, I think, is one of them who has said, look, we need to maybe step back and really give this second thought. Yes, we need to do something, but we don't need to do it this minute, this second, this day. We need to do something, but maybe we need to step back and take just a little bit of time and look at something a little bit better than what was on the plate. And I think that's an intelligent approach.
I think absolutely. You know, you know, but not do nothing like the Hoover administration did during the last crash. And then when Hoover came out and actually did something, what did he do? He bailed out the banks. So are we just reliving history? I mean, are we just throwing good money after bad? You know, and the thing is we've been here before, and I know we got to get to the labor report, but we've been here before. In my estimation, what we should be doing is we should set up a private corporation with public money to go in and buy all those mortgages that are on the verge of bankruptcy. And you buy them at market value right now. The banks are going to take a beating. And you sell those mortgages at a fixed rate, at market value, and allow those people to stay in their homes thus strengthening the communities so that my property values don't fall any further. And stabilizing the market, taking those toxic mortgages off of their back, but they're going to take a beating over it. And in 30 years, we're going to get our money back. That's the way it should be happening. Because in 30 years, those mortgages are going to pay off. In 30 years, we're going to get that money back. What's worrying me about this is that there isn't much of that language there. And we're going to talk to Amanda Logan a little bit later in the program about just that. But let's get to the labor report, because I know you got some stuff we need to get to.
Well, if I can quickly ask, Rick, why do you pick the figure 30 years? The way some of them are talking, it far short of that, we'll be able to perhaps incrementally get some of that money back for the Treasury? Or is that a dead set figure?
Dead set. 30 years, this is what we did in the past. I forget the name of the organization, but they set up this private corporation with public money. And they said, you're going to be in business to buy these loans for the next 3 years. So for 3 years, they bought these loans. Okay? And as those loans were paid off, the taxpayers got their money back. And this corporation then dissolved when all the mortgages were paid off, which is a 30-year period. The length of the longest mortgages right now is about 30 years. I've seen some 40, I've seen some 50, but not too many. 30 years is about the average. So in 30 years, that private corporation is now defunct because you've got your money back. And that's the way I see it. Now, over time, you're going to get a little bit incrementally more money back, of course. But at the end of the 30 years, you're done with it. And this is the kind of investment that really only government can do. And that's why I think it has to be done with public money. And quite frankly, we've done it before, and there's a perfect example for it. And I think that's the way we should go. So let's move on, and let's get to the labor report.
Okay. Philadelphia Mixers, there have been some developments in the last couple of weeks. Apparently what has happened, they have come to an agreement with their employer. At this point, they have not revealed exactly what was in that agreement. In the future, we hope to bring more news to you. But in fact, for all intents and purposes, that strike is over. And again, I want to salute those guys. For 10 months, they hung tough. Nobody crossed the picket line. And they got the best possible deal they could. And I salute those gentlemen 100%. God love them.
Yeah, you got to give them credit.
McCain's healthcare plan modeled after failed banking industries. John McCain wants to change our healthcare system. And we've discussed this before, but I believe it deserves a little more in-depth looking at. And model it after the crisis-ridden banks. This is what John McCain said. Opening up the health insurance market to more vigorous nationwide competition, as we have done over that decade in banking, would provide more choices of innovative products, less burdened by the most excesses of state-based regulation. Now, what would that mean if John McCain got his way? The consequences of McCain's health care plan would mean that while millions of working families would be paying for a new tax on their health benefits, millions more would be dropped from their existing coverage entirely. Families would be left with no health care coverage, facing an insurance industry unregulated and all too willing to offer confusing, expensive policies that offer inadequate, expensive coverage. The bottom line is, the authors of a report that has come out in the last couple of weeks estimate that 20 million people would lose their health care coverage they have now under McCain's plan. 20 million. The effects could even be more devastating under McCain's plan, given the fact that it would take away an incentive to employers to cover these people. In fact, it would give an incentive to drop coverage and push workers into the private market. We're talking an additional 20 million workers uninsured.
Well, I mean, if you look at the maverick John McCain, what he actually said about health care and his health care plan, he said that it's going to raise 100% taxes on the work on certain working class people. And the maverick said, and this is a quote from the maverick, only those with Cadillac gold plated health insurance policies today are the ones who might suffer from his health care plan. And you know, I gotta tell you, where are you gonna find health insurance for $5,000 a year for you and your family? Good luck on that. And, you know, the Center for American Progress did an excellent little study on this. And they're estimating that by 2018, the average person, the average taxpayer, is going to pay almost $3,000 a year more in taxes because of McCain's plan. Because that's, you know, because the average person, I pay about 12 grand a year for health insurance. And that means I'm going to spend an additional $7,000 being taxed. That is going to be the largest tax increase since Ronald Reagan and Alan Greenspan stuck the working class with that Social Security increase they pulled.
But isn't there another hidden cost by dropping even more? The average person, I don't think, understands that because of the large number of unemployed, there's $1,000 built into every insurance policy, health insurance policy, whether you get it through your employer or whether you buy it. If the number of uninsured is increased dramatically, that pressure will be even greater. So we're not only getting a cost up front, we're getting a hidden cost under the McCain plan.
Yeah, you know, and the thing is he keeps saying that, oh, it's going to get more people buying health insurance. No, it's not. It's going to, what it's going to end up doing is it's going to end up having the employer say, you know what, I'm not getting a tax credit for it. I'm not going to offer it anymore. So that's going to put more people out on the street, which inevitably is going to raise the prices on everybody else who has it.
Think of what he's saying. The average cost we've estimated for family coverage around $12,000. That's pretty accurate. How many people earning an average income can afford that an additional cost? Very, very few.
Yeah, it's amazing. And it's amazing that we're even talking about this. I mean, that's what gets me. It's amazing that we're even talking about it.
Moving on here, a recent study shows the reversal of African-American economic progress. A recent study shows that nearly all the economic gains made by African-Americans during the 1990s have eroded, even as the economy grew. Since 2000, according to EPI, wages for the median black workers have stagnated, incomes and employments have declined, and poverty has increased. According to this study, African-American median family incomes declined by $404 or 1% between 2000 and 2007. And this is the key. This is the first decline in black median family income in a business cycle of this length since World War II. More chilling, African-American income relative to whites has dropped. In the last 8 years, for example, in 1995, the median black family earned about 61% of the median white family. By 2000, the ratio had climbed to a record high of 64. But by 2005, it had dropped to about 60% of white households. The bottom line, reckon all this, and these are very disturbing figures. Most of that can be attributed to the fact that black workers, like white workers, the number of unionized workers has dropped dramatically. Hence the drop in income.
And this is why the right-wingers are out there saying that this whole mortgage crisis is caused by minorities. And in the next segment, I want to talk about that a little bit. Let's take a break. We're right back after this. The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
What's your point?
Changing the discussion is what it is. It's that deflection. It's getting away from the discussion. Which, you know, I got to tell you, Sarah Palin, an outstanding person at doing just that, just deflecting the argument.
Joe Sixpack, hockey moms, say it ain't so, Joe, there you'll go again. Doggone it. Nuclear weaponry, darn right. And I'll bet you, darn right. And here's a shout out to all those third graders at Gladyswood Elementary School. Drill, baby, drill. John McCain, maverick, consummate maverick. Send the maverick from the Senate and put him in the White House. And I've joined this team that is a team of mavericks. What do you expect? A team of mavericks, a sinking corpse.
Oh, golly. Yeah, my wife and I were talking about it while the debate's going on. And my wife goes to me, is she going to ever answer a question? And the answer is no. It wasn't on the note cards.
It almost reminds you of the Beverly Hillbillies. Oh, golly gee.
Yeah, but the thing is, you know, you look at Palin, and she's really just Bush in a dress. Just an empty vessel between the ears that they just put a couple of talking points in and then pull the string, and, you know, there you go. And, you know, here's the thing, really. I mean, around the world, the people around the world have got to be looking at us going, wow, are you just the dumbest people on the planet? Electing Bush? Well, I can't say we elected Bush. I mean, there were a lot of shenanigans that got him elected. But we've allowed him to stay for 8 years. And now we're talking about putting the guy who was fifth from the bottom of his class, got into the Naval Academy, I'll bet you only because Daddy was an admiral and Grandpa was an admiral as well. Do you think he got some help getting into the Naval Academy? Do you think? Just like Bush got some help getting into Yale. I mean, Bush couldn't get into Texas. Couldn't get into the University of Texas. They said, no, you're too stupid to get in here. But Yale, one of the historic institutions of this country. Oh, yeah, sure. Come on in. Yeah, right here. Sit next to this person. He'll do your homework for you. It's just amazing to me. And the average person looks at that and goes, I'm okay with it. Or they must. I mean, I guess it takes me back to Paul Krugman and that know-nothingism. That the Republicans really don't care if their leaders know anything. It's more about narrative. It's about that story than it is about facts and about issues. It's about that sunny optimism that, oh, you know, you know, everything's going to be wonderful. Don't worry. We'll take care of it. I don't know. You know, I keep getting this vision in my head of, you know, of someone sitting watching that debate with their TV tray in front of them, eating out of the TV dinner going, look, Ma, she's stupid like me. I'm going to vote for her because she's dumb as I am. Really? I mean, come on. Why would you vote for her? Why in the name of the good Lord would you vote for this dimwit?
Well, because she's one of us.
Well, like I said, she's stupid like me. I mean, geez, oh, man, I got a guy who comes to me every day, and isn't she great? Isn't John McCain just the greatest, most intelligent guy on the planet? And he means it. That's what scares me. He asked me the question the other day. He goes, would you go hunting with Sarah Palin? Would you go moose hunting with her? And if she shot a moose, would you eat her meat? And I said, well, if she cooked it right. You know, I don't know.
You love steak. Yeah, you probably wouldn't.
I probably would. And, you know, here's the thing. She's probably someone great to go moose hunting with. And she's someone to cheer for the kids on the sideline. Yay, go team. But she is not. Let me repeat. She is not someone to sit in the Oval Office. In fact, she shouldn't even be allowed to sit on a lawn chair outside the gate in front of the Oval Office. I suspect I've gone too far.
I agree with you. It is frightening. But to get back to reality a bit here, all one had to do is watch her performance at those debates. And I know some people say, well, she fought into a draw. And the wacko conservatives, I mean, you know, the ones you expect to be out there cheering, you know, like Sean Hannity. Yeah, well, Sean Hannity, according to Sean Hannity, I mean, that was the greatest speech since, you know, George Washington's inauguration speech.
Oh, and you
listen to him.
And Fred Thompson said, well, she gave that speech off the cuff because she had a problem with her teleprompter.
Yeah, but it's better. I mean, not only, according to them, did she do well, but she saved for the second time the McCain campaign.
She brought him from the depths of hell and saved his campaign and brought him back to life, which, you know, as his nurse, I'm sure if he's elected, she's going to have to do a couple of times a day. She better learn CPR. But here's the thing. And I love this. Giuliani came out and said that she did so well in the debates. She proved herself so well in the debates that she's not going to have to do any more interviews. That she's not talking to the media. She's already proved everything she needs to prove. She said all she needs to say, and that's it. And I go, yeah, because she's an idiot. I mean, this woman has nothing to say if it's not written down on the note cards. I mean, you watch a speech. Go back and watch that debate. And I went back and I watched it for a second time. Every time she answered, she looked down and she was checking her note cards. Mm-hmm. And her final statement was entirely read.
She read.
She read every word verbatim off of those note cards. And I give her credit. You know, she can give a good presentation. But a decent presentation is not.
But on you know, what's scary is, Rick, the American people aren't asking her to know everything about everything, but they are expecting, and I think reasonably so, to have a basic understanding of the important issues. Now, how hard is that? I mean, that last, the closing speech was what, a couple minutes?
2 minutes.
Okay. I mean, come on. A basic understanding of the issues? I think that's the minimum requirement.
I love the question, and they gave her pretty much a softball and said, which Supreme Court cases don't you agree with? And she could name no Supreme Court cases. Now, this is a woman who's anti-abortion. I mean, if that's, you know, someone asks you that softball, of course, Roe v. Wade.
Roe v. Wade. She opposes.
Right. You would have come to me and said, any Supreme Court cases you don't agree with? Yeah, the Ledbetter case. Right off the top of my head. Boom. That's it. Simple. But she has nothing. What newspapers do you read, Sarah? She didn't have an answer. I mean, she couldn't even name her hometown newspaper. I mean, you ask me, Rick, what newspapers do you read? Well, I read The Patriot, I read The Sentinel, USA Today occasionally, Washington Times. You know, because it's a crazy right-winger who owns the Washington Times. The New York Times, The Post, you know, I read all of these. And I'm not running for vice president. But here's a woman who's supposedly up on the issues. Is this another Bush? Someone who doesn't read? I mean, the whole reason a lot of the catastrophes that have happened in this country are because Bush refuses to read.
Well, I mean, obviously, again, going back, and this is rehashing, she wasn't picked because of her intellect. She was picked because it would appeal to a certain segment of the power structure in the Republican Party.
Oh, golly. Oh, golly. Gosh, gee willikers. We're going to put Leave It to Beaver back on TV. Can't wait. Oh, boy. Sarah Palin for president. Leave It to Beaver back on TV. You know, force moms back into the home. Boy, I think I'm going to like this. Maybe I will vote for
you. You mean Sarah, can I call you Joe?
Can I call you Joe? Hi, Joe.
And she knew her mic was on. She knew
of
that
course.
Was going to be.
That was done on purpose.
Sure.
But, you know, I got to tell you, I loved the response from Joe Biden when he was talking about being a maverick.
The change is coming, and John McCain is the leader of that reform.
I'll be very brief. Can I respond to that? Look, the maverick, let's talk about the maverick John McCain is. And again, I love him. He's been a maverick on some issues, but he has been no maverick on the things that matter to people's lives. He voted 4 to 5 times for George Bush's budget, which put us $500 billion in debt this year and over $3 trillion in debt since he's got there. He has not been a maverick in providing health care for people. He has voted against. He voted against including another 3.6 million children in coverage. Of the existing health care plan when he voted in the United States Senate. He's not been a maverick when it comes to education. He has not supported tax cuts and significant changes for people being able to send their kids to college. He's not been a maverick on the war. He's not been a maverick on virtually anything that genuinely affects the things that people really talk about around the kitchen table. Can we get mom's MRI? Can we send Mary back to school next semester? We can't make it. How are we going to heat the car? The House this winter. He voted against even providing for what they call LIHEAP, for assistance to people with oil prices going through the roof in the winter. So maverick he is not on the important critical issues that affect people at that kitchen table.
Well, I mean, he's a maverick on pulling out of Michigan. I mean, that's really the dumbest thing I've ever heard. A month before the election, you're going to pull out of a state that you really got a shot of winning? What kind of... But he's a maverick. He's the maverick. See, he's so confident in himself, he's going to pull out.
But if he's such a maverick, why did he in the last year. Reversed himself on tax breaks for the rich. He had it right. He had it right originally. He opposed it because it was needless. It put us in debt up to our ears. It was given to people who didn't deserve it, didn't need it.
I think you're
people
wrong.
Who didn't stimulate the economy. Many of these people realized, hey, I can take the money overseas and avoid taxes totally.
I don't think he was against it for those reasons at all. I think when we talked to Carrie Telasco a couple of weeks ago, I think she was right. He was just mad at George Bush, and he chose to oppose Bush's policy just to tick him off because he was angry.
Well, how about the inheritance tax? Same thing?
Well, I think so. I got to tell you, this is what she said. I'm taking her word for it. She's the right-wing pundit. She should know. She's saying that this is just him being a petulant child and being the maverick. Petulant child, maverick.
So you're telling me that John McCain has made major decisions based on anger?
Well, this is what she said. And if you know anything about McNasty, he's a guy who lets his temper get the best of him quite often. And I'm surprised that they really haven't, that it hasn't to this point, because he doesn't put himself in forums that he's going to be asked any real questions. And the fact is, and we're going to talk about later in the show, about the fact that the mainstream media has really coddled him. Every time he flubs something, they edit it, or they cut it out, or they don't air it. I mean, you're not getting what this guy's doing, because he's offering billions of dollars worth of tax cuts to these major media outlets, and it's coming.
Or when he flubs up, I've heard this a couple times, and it's getting old. He'll have a major screw-up, and they'll say, well, you know what? We need to give him a break because he showed a lot of courage and he showed a lot of tenacity while he was a prisoner of war. Yes, he did. But come on, that doesn't excuse every guffaw. He's running for president now.
That's it.
And let's not forget that there were hundreds of prisoners of war in North Vietnam who deserve our respect too. But that doesn't make them, that doesn't innately give them the ability to lead this country. And another issue that kind of bothers me, they're giving him a pass on his lack of support for veterans' issues again. You would think this man would be leading the band. He'd be the head cheerleader. He'd be out there pounding, pounding, pounding. We need to take care of the veterans who we asked to fight and die for this country. And he has not.
That's right.
He has a bad record.
He's got a horrible record. D-minus from the Iraq vets. 41% from the American, the injured vets. Just not good, not a good record. And I think Phil Avillo yesterday talked about it, and he was right spot on. You respect his service, but this is a guy who hasn't been there and hasn't really stood up. And we've got to meet that compact that we make with.
And I'd like to hear these talking heads who have gone after people saying that they aren't patriotic because they disagree with the Iraq policy. How can a candidate for the United States presidency turn their backs and oppose a bill which would allocate more money to the VA to take care of thousands of veterans coming back with severe emotional and mental problems, and they are coming back in those conditions? He opposed that. How can you justify that? I'd like to hear these self-righteous right-wingers. I'd like to hear them explain that one. You want to talk about what's right? You want to talk about what's moral? I want to hear you explain John McCain's position on that issue.
Oh, he's a maverick. He's a maverick. We're going to take a break, and we'll come back and talk about the maverick. He's so maverick.
Power to the people.
So boy, if that isn't the truth, I don't know what is. I don't know if you saw this report this week. The Institute for Supply Management reported on Wednesday that the nation's manufacturers are cutting back production at a much faster pace than expected, and it's at the lowest level since October of 2001. The ISM index plunged to 43.5 in September from 49.9 in August, the biggest drop in index since 1984. And you know, we look at what's going on in Wall Street, and we look at all the financial crisis and things that are going on, and yeah, I got to tell you, it's scary times. So I've asked Amanda Logan from the Center for American Progress to come in and give us a little overview of what's going on, what this latest bill is really about, and what we can expect in the coming days. Amanda, are you there?
I'm here, Rick. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you taking time for us. You know, I look at this bailout, and most people are dead set against it. My gut reaction is against it, but I do understand that at some point we have to get away from that and start thinking about the entire economy instead of just Wall Street.
That's right. You know, we unfortunately found ourselves in a really difficult situation, not just, you know, the last 2 weeks as Congress was working to pass this legislation, but just finding ourselves in such a dire situation overall. But the bailout plan was, as you said, a necessary, albeit not perfect, measure. But it was necessary to pass in order to restore liquidity, credit, and confidence in the American financial system. And, you know, hopefully we will have dodged a bullet, and we're going to see things start to smooth out over the next couple of weeks and months. But we still have a lot of systemic problems that many Americans are feeling across the country, which is why I think there's been a little bit of gut reaction, as you described, to people saying, wait a minute, why are we bailing out all these billionaires on Wall Street when I can't pay my mortgage and I'm having trouble filling up my gas tank? Oh. But the important thing to keep in mind here is that this action was necessary not to help the millionaires, you know, save their jet or something like that, but because if this action wasn't taken, if the credit that we rely on so heavily in the economy wouldn't be there. So kind of think of it as if businesses can't borrow money, the grease that kind of makes the American economy work wouldn't be there so much. And, you know, you say your employer needed to borrow some money to help make his payroll for the month. You could feel that impact by your paycheck not being there fully. Businesses that need to borrow to have the next month's shipment go out, you might see things not show up on the stores. And this isn't stuff that takes place, you know, next week, next month. But if we hadn't acted as Congress was forced to act, we could see those things have start to happen in the next couple of months.
Right, you know, but I look at this, and most of the people I've talked to, they kind of get that, but it's that, you know, here, once again, we're rewarding bad behavior. And you go back to the 80s when we bailed out the savings and loan, with McCain being one of the Keating Five, and we bailed them out, and we saw, you know, the wealthy getting wealthier, and the taxpayer being fleeced for another $600 billion, and here we are again. So let me ask you this. What is there anything in this bill to help protect this from happening again? Have we begun looking at oversight? Have we begun looking at maybe investigating who really is to blame and start going after some heads?
Yeah, I think that is something that progressives especially kept in mind as they were working through this legislation. You know, they understand the anger and the frustration with how do we get ourselves in this situation again and kind of in a worse situation. And that's why I think the bill did not pass the first time, and both sides were forced to make some compromises and sacrifices. And we did see a definite push for both taxpayer protections as well as oversight from the Financial Stability Board as well as the Congressional Oversight Board. So we have two separate bodies working to make sure things are going as they're supposed to be going. There's a lot of responsibilities that the Treasury is going to have to do in order to make sure that the businesses, the financial institutions who are selling their troubled assets are actually sticking to their end of the bargain. And as I said, they're also, in addition to protecting the taxpayer by, you know, making sure if in 5 years there's actually a loss to the program, those companies that are getting helped out are going to have to foot part of that bill. But there are also new accountability rules that I kind of find myself asking, why didn't we have these accountability and accounting rules before? But it's better to get them tucked in there now than find ourselves in this situation in a couple of years. So I think Congress did take seriously both the frustrations felt on Main Street with everything going on and also just the realization that we cannot let this happen again. There were a number of things going wrong, a number of people who kind of looked the other way, and then at a macro level that just combusted to get us to this horrible credit situation that we are in today.
Right. We're here with Amanda Logan.
Hopefully aren't in today, but we're close to being in, I should say.
Alrighty, we're here with Amanda Logan. She's a research associate with the Economic Policy Team at the Center for American Progress. Their website, AmericanProgress.org. You know, Amanda, you know, one of the things I've been hearing from right-wing pundits all week long is that this crisis was brought on because we gave loans to minorities. This crisis was because poor people took out loans that they couldn't afford. They really were attacking this Community Reinvestment Act. And in my research that I'm looking at, that's really not the case.
Yes, I think that is one of the most unfortunate statements that I have heard coming from the media over the course of this story, this occurrence, and that's not really the case. You know, credit isn't a bad thing. Home ownership isn't a bad thing. And some of the loans that were extended, albeit they were, you know, they had a little bit higher risk involved in them, but ultimately, when loans are designed properly and help get people into a home they otherwise couldn't have and are designed with, you know, their long-term financial situation, not setting people up to fail, it's a good thing. We want to improve or increase family's wealth, and home ownership is a good way to do that. And it's not the fault of, you know, trying to lift minorities or other low-income families up into a higher wealth situation, and I think it's really unfortunate that we're trying to shift the blame here, but, you know, the fact is there's a lot of finger-pointing going on. Nobody wants to take responsibility for the situation, and it's really sad that we see a group of people who are all too often blamed for many problems in America stealing the blame again, but I really don't think that the blame should be allowed to rest on this group of people. If anything, we should be looking, really, as you pointed to before, what was going on with regulation here, what was going on with people who were supposed to be overseeing all of these loans, overseeing how they were being repackaged and resold again. And we really shouldn't look to the groups of people who need our most help right now.
Well, I agree. And the person that I blame is Ronald Reagan. I go back to him because I blame him for all of the problems we're having right now, because this is his vision. This is what he told us he was going to do. He's going to strip all regulations away and let the market dictate, and this is where we're at. We're in the cancer stage of capitalism where it's just eating itself. And once again, we're going to have a Democrat come in, just like we did in the 30s, and save capitalism from itself and save work from itself, because over the last 30 years, incomes have actually been going down. And
I'm sorry. I'm really glad you brought up this point, Rick. And I think a lot of people, your listeners, know that this isn't something that started, you know, last week, last month. American families have been hurting for quite a while, and it's unfortunate that it took this large of a crisis to get the rest of the American population to realize, wow, a lot of people are hurting. There are a lot of things fundamentally wrong in our economy. But as you said, hopefully we can move forward from here and start to address some of the other issues that we're facing, like stagnant wages, the weak labor market. You know, yesterday's, or rather 2 days ago, the jobs report came out, and we've now lost 760,000 jobs this year in the American economy. And there are a lot of other issues at play here, but hopefully, you know, we can refocus, possibly pass a second stimulus package and get the country set on the proper path again to really restore growth and shared benefits of that growth to all Americans.
Yeah, a second stimulus package, not handing out checks to people to go, here, go out, be irresponsible. Why not invest in our country? Why not create jobs and say, you know what, we're going to have public works projects again to get people back to work? That's a smart way of stimulating the economy, not handing out a couple of bucks and going, here, go be irresponsible like you've been the last, we've all been the last 30 years.
Yeah, that's true. There are really, if we were able to pass a second stimulus package, we really have an opportunity to help both some of the groups who are hurting most right now, and like you said, to help stimulate job growth, particularly if we were to jumpstart our transformation to a low-carbon economy. Center for American Progress put out a green recovery plan a couple of weeks or maybe a month ago, and under our plan, we would create 2 million jobs over 2 years by investing in 6 green investment areas and under the government. As the last few minutes said, we really need to consider expanding unemployment insurance with, you know, the unemployment rate rising, the duration of unemployment increasing as we continue down this weak labor market path. Only 37% of jobless workers right now are qualifying for unemployment insurance benefits. So we need to extend that and extend some help to families. As we're getting closer to winter with heating and gas costs still, you know, really high compared to where they were a couple of years ago, we should look to increasing energy assistance. Similarly, as more and more people are unemployed and finding themselves in a hard financial situation, we need to think about expanding Medicaid aid to the states, because states are not having the, or finding themselves rather in a hard budgetary standpoint, as, you know, they're feeling the effects of the economic downturn. They're having lower revenues, in large part because of the lower tax revenues that they're able to get from property taxes. And we can even, you know, boost food stamp support again. So there's a lot of things that could really inject some money into the economy quickly and help out people who are hurting right now, as well as get us back on track with job growth and, you know, really even catapult our transformation to the low-carbon energy economy.
That would be a great thing. But let me ask you, in your personal economic expertise, are we looking at the possibility of bread lines again, or is this going to work?
Well, I think, as I stated at the beginning, we've hopefully dodged a bullet right now. But if this were our only action to take this bailout package, you know, we're probably not really addressing everything that's going on in the economy. So it's going to take a concentrated effort at from both parties in both chambers and across the administration to make sure that our focus is on getting us out of the downturn that we've been experiencing for quite some time. I think that we did dodge a bullet here with this package, and it looks like liquidity is going to be restored and some confidence is going to come back to the markets. But if we don't keep our eye on the ball here or in the long term, you know, we're not going to see the people who have been hurting increasingly more over the last 8 years benefit that much more. So we really do need to concentrate our efforts here on improving the economic stability for all Americans.
All right, Grace, let me ask you this. We've got about a minute left. Did you happen to watch Thursday night's debate?
I did. I enjoyed that debate, Rick.
And I just wanted to get your opinion on it.
On the performance or on the debate. I think that, you know, we saw a very strong difference in the two parties' views on a number of issues. In particular, I was surprised at how many times the topic of tax cuts and what would happen with job creation versus killing jobs. And one thing that I thought was unfortunate was that Governor Palin kept saying that if we were to have tax increases on the wealthy under the Obama Biden ticket, that we would kill all of these jobs. When if you actually look to the economic policy plan that the Democratic ticket has, it's actually very focused on job creation. And I think that's something that American voters are wanting to hear, promised to them, need to hear promised to them, and should really take to heart as we move towards the election and not listen to you know, just a line that, tax increases lead to the killing off jobs, when actually we've seen that quite the opposite.
Well, do you think she actually believed that, or was it just written on a note card for her to read?
I'm not sure. I can't really tell you on that, but she sure seemed to want to emphasize that point. I was surprised at how many times she answered a question with that talking point, even when the question was about something else. But she sure, regardless of what she personally believes, she wanted the American people to believe that.
All right. Well, I appreciate you taking time for us. Amanda Logan from the Center for American Progress. For more information, go to their website at americanprogress.org. Amanda, always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks again for having me, Rick.
All righty. We're going to take a break. We're right back after this, the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. nonprofit media this week? Been watching any of that? All yes. All I've been hearing is how great Sarah Maverick Barracuda Hockey Mom Palin is, how great she is, and how, you know, I love this, how the mainstream media wants Obama to win. I've been hearing that a bunch. And, you know, I may be crazy, but I don't see anyone out there editing Obama's interviews or editing Obama's speeches to make them sound better. But, you know, they're doing that for McCain every chance they get. And there's absolutely no rational thought that goes along with those false claims. There's not. You know, here's the thing. Our mainstream media are owned by a handful of multinational corporations. GE owns NBC, Time Warner owns CNN, Walt Disney owns ABC, News Corp owns Fox, Viacom owns CBS. I mean, they were talking major conglomerates, huge companies. And, you know, the thing is under McCain's plans, they're going to benefit economically through these massive tax cuts that he's going to give them, which is the Maverick centerpiece of his whole campaign. That's the Maverick. You know, it's his whole plan. Give tax cuts to rich people. Give tax cuts to corporations. In fact, he's going to give these companies about $1.5 billion in tax cuts over the next couple of years. And I got to tell you, you know, it's disheartening.
When you get into telecommunications, one could reach a natural conclusion and that would only not only enhance them economically, but it would help certain companies to buy up other countries and consolidate the industry, to restrict the industry. And certainly, that's one of the problems right now. A few people control all the media.
I know, the thing is that these giveaways are just one part of McCain's insanity. Doubling the Bush tax cuts for the corporations and for wealthy people, which is going to create even larger deficits than we've had for the last 25 years. It's insane. It's absolutely insane. And this is, you know, this is the McCain plan. You know, I just don't get it. How is it that we can give people who don't really need the money huge tax cuts? How is that possible? When you've got people who are living on the streets, working for a living. When you've got people leaving their homes, it doesn't make any sense to me. And no one's given me a rational explanation other than if we give them all the money, they might possibly, conceivably, on paper, think about possibly almost maybe creating a job.
Well, I mean, one has to conclude that, and then perhaps this is being a bit overstating it, but the big lie theory, Rick, if you say it long enough and loud enough, people will believe it. It stimulated the economy. Look at the numbers of the economy. How did that stimulate the economy? I'd like to ask Bush and his apologists, how did that stimulate the economy?
It didn't. It made rich people very wealthy.
You know, sometimes I know, they insult the intelligence level of the average American. The average American looks at that and compares that with a tax break to themselves. Many of them are making, let's say anywhere from 35 to 60, 70,000 a year with several kids. Every dollar that they are given will be, for most people, put back into the economy. Your children need clothes.
Yep.
Your wife needs a new refrigerator. You have the expense of all kinds of things, raising a family and children. And you're going to spend that on making sure that your family is taken care of. But by doing that, you're investing back into the economy, which in theory is what was supposed to happen. And you compare that to a billionaire. I mean, come on. What are they going to do with that money for the most part?
Well, they're going to invest it for their great-grandchildren to have a trust fund.
Or, again...
All right, let's...